confirmed COVID-19 infections exceeded 1 million, with over 20,000 cases being reported daily. The economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic, massive layoffs, and rising unemployment levels in Europe have added to already lingering concerns about public health. The mayors of 9 cities have bypassed their national governments to write directly to the president of the European Council, Charles Michel, demanding access to the 750 billion euro EU recovery fund. Protesters from across the continent are calling on their governments to provide greater financial support to those hit worst by the pandemic. In Italy, a tipping point appears to be disturbingly close. Angry demonstrations erupted in Naples just over a week ago after a local curfew was imposed. The protests were followed by a civil order in Milan and Turin, where luxury stores were looted. A poll following last week's mini-riots found that over three-quarters of Italians believe there will be more violence in the streets this winter. Experts also believe it is quite likely that countries like France that witnessed unprecedented strikes and protests before the pandemic even began face serious social unrest.
The potential economic damage from the virus and from new lockdowns is of course very considerable. Already we've seen European economies shrink at times during this year, and several governments, including the British government, have introduced financial schemes to help companies keep people employed. So, for example, here in Britain, we've had what's called a furlough scheme, where companies are paid 80% of workers' wages while they are in fact at home, not working. But of course, that will be very, very expensive for the country, and Britain and other countries in Europe are running up huge debts and deficits, which will have to be paid off one day.
The stakes were remarkably high before the first lockdowns were imposed back in March, but they may be even higher now.
In yet another embarrassment for the US government, new evidence has come to light that a plot aimed at overthrowing the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has shown that the very highest echelons of Washington were aware of what was about to happen, as the plans appear to have been conceived in a Trump-owned complex. The apparent coup plot was instigated in the so-called Trump Doral, a golf course in Florida, where the alleged perpetrators of the act met on the green grass of the 12th fairway, planning to overthrow Nicolas Maduro while circumnavigating the bunkers of the golf course in the process. The failed coup saw dozens of people arrested by Venezuelan forces, with many of the detained being US citizens and having links to the US-backed Juan Guaido, hence proving that the US are more than certainly involved in the plot. The clear failure by the mercenaries to overthrow Maduro in the coup shows that in spite of having one of the world's largest military forces, as well as having an almost blank checkbook funded by the CIA, the Americans have a long way to go before they are able to upstage any government in South America, or for that matter, anywhere else in the world, suggesting that the US attempt to fund a coup in Venezuela is a clear failure and an embarrassment for the Americans.
Yeah, absolutely does. It's a catastrophic failure. Just an utterly sort of laughable, pathetic, Bay of Piglets, as it was referred to by many. Not a very terribly serious seeming coup attempt in terms of what the United States has done in the past, but a coup attempt nonetheless. Absolutely, the Trump administration's fingerprints are all over this, although officially Vice President Pence has described this lawsuit that we see now from Jordan Goudreau, who was sort of in charge of plotting this coup and signing it with would-be sort of pseudo-president Juan Guaido, who is in fact obviously not the president of any sovereign territory or country.
As with multiple lies delivered by the US and their failed foreign policy attempts, the embarrassing failure in Venezuela is yet another notch that the US can add to their miseries when trying to destabilize any nation around the world, especially a nation that's shown the ability and skill to resist, much to the shame of Washington. It seems that the US does not seem to care whether it succeeds or fails when it comes to its foreign policies, with example after example showing that failures are part and parcel of the US statecraft that we've all seen over the last few decades. So-called intelligence leads in the past have all shown how the lies justified by the Americans and their allies have all come to no results, and have left all the decision-makers at the top very red-faced in the process, with one such example of seeing the Saddam regime in possession of weapons of mass destruction. This is clearly the best example of them all. But in spite of the clear failures demonstrated by the US and its proxies, the fact that they can continue as if nothing had happened in the first place is something that needs to be addressed. Yet is something that appears to be just another story brushed under the carpet, in spite of evidence clearly showing that the Americans were wrong in the first place. The question that now remains to be asked is whether the US are happy to live and let live when it comes to such massive failures. Or will the red mist settle in front of the eyes of the hawks in Washington, D.C., and mean that the US will seek to gain revenge in the future in ever more harder and brutal ways?
Although I am generally hesitant to draw any real distinction between the foreign policy of the Democrats and the Republicans in the sense that they both sort of ultimately want similar things, which is to say U.S. domination of the world's people and resources, there may be some differences here in terms of the presidential election in the United States. Donald Trump obviously is playing to a very far-right fringe of Venezuelans, wealthy elite Venezuelans who live in Florida. These people are not representative, of course, of any of the normal Venezuelan population, nor are they representative of the normal Florida population.
The truth of the matter is, however, that the attempted coup in Venezuela, for example, is nothing more than an easily deniable event of the past, and is something that, like many other US-backed destabilizing techniques, will remain nothing more than a story gracing the pages of Wikipedia, hence allowing the US to continue their calamitous foreign policies, safe in the knowledge that the denial policy is always best, and that any stories that do eventually emerge will never be acted upon.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. the limelight.
As Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris delivered acceptance speeches Saturday night, November 7th, Trump bucked the tradition of congratulating the winners and instead spent the evening tweeting out claims that he won the election and making allegations of fraud, says John Quilley, a writer, in an article published under the heading Trump Faces Growing Fury Over His Refusal to Concede Defeat to Biden. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Increasing levels of anger and frustration were voiced on Sunday, November 8, as U.S. President Donald Trump continued his refusal to accept the election results that show he was defeated. Even as Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris delivered acceptance speeches on Saturday night, November 7th, Trump bucked the tradition of congratulating the winners and instead spent the evening tweeting out claims that he won the election and making allegations of fraud in U.S. election. As CNN reports, Trump so far has refused to accept the election results, waging a legal strategy to contest them in courts and issuing allegations of fraud. There are currently no plans to invite Biden to the Oval Office for the traditional meeting between the incoming and outgoing presidents, a historic sign of the peaceful transfer of power. Aides instead are working to craft ways for the U.S. president to feel validated even in less, including through more rallies. But after claiming publicly that he won the election, sources say Trump is not denying the outcome privately. And two people said Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and senior advisor who oversaw his campaign from the White House, has approached Trump about conceding the election. On Sunday, November 8, as the claims by the U.S. President Donald Trump continued, many Trump critics began to lose their patience. It is obscene for a president of the United States to talk of a stolen election when he has not put up any meaningful evidence of any more stealing the election, said Stephen Greenhouse, former labor reporter for the New York Times, in a Sunday morning tweet. The president needs to stop putting his narcissistic selfishness over what is good for our nation and our democracy, he added. Stephen King, the famed novelist and an avowed Democrat, was even more blunt in his proclamation. You lost, you miserable, self-entitled, infantile person, King declared. Concede and get the hell out. In a letter to editor at Guardian on Sunday, November 8th, reader Pete Dury in the UK said he fears that Trump's disputing of the validity of the election result is much more insidious than him simply being a bad loser, Dury wrote. By repeatedly denouncing the accuracy of the outcome, even before it has been confirmed, Trump is giving his supporters a green light to spend the next 4 years blatantly defying a Biden government and generally causing public mayhem, on the grounds that Democrats stole the election from Trump and that the new government thus has no Democratic authority of mandate. As such, many fear that mass protests across the U.S., the occupation of public buildings, and intimidation, especially of black communities by gun-toting Trump and Biden supporters, will become a routine occurrence, justified on the grounds that ignoring the undemocratic Biden government is the duty of true American patriots. If tough punitive action is taken against them, they will claim that democracy and liberty are being suppressed by radical leftists in Washington. But if their mayhem is ignored, they will claim that law and order is being undermined due to a weak government enthralled to political correctness and snowflake liberals. Ahead of Biden being declared the projected winner by nearly every major news outlet in the U.S. on Saturday, November 7th, his campaign spokesperson Andrew Bates on Friday, November 6th, said their team was not ultimately worried if Trump, when defeated, refused to leave the White House voluntarily. The United States government, said Bates, is perfectly capable of escorting trespassers out of the White House. According to reports on Friday, November 6th, a viral claim that Pennsylvania had 21,000 dead people on its voter rolls spread across the internet. In some versions of the rumor, those deceased people had voted for the Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. The right-wing publication wrote in an article about this issue. Others then cited it as evidence that Democrats were trying to steal the election. Rudy Giuliani, President Donald Trump's personal lawyer, shared the article on Twitter.
European News Bulletin.
Leaders from around the world have congratulated former Vice President Joe Biden on winning the U.S. presidential election, despite allegations of electoral fraud from sitting President Donald Trump, who has so far refused to concede. World leaders are already preparing for a new approach with hopes the U.S. will rejoin the World Health Organization in the Paris Climate Accords. In the U.K., talks of a U.S. trade deal have come with caveats of the Good Friday Peace Agreement, which weakens the U.K.'s negotiating stance when it comes to Brexit, something Downing Street was not too concerned about with Trump. In Iran, the government remains cautious, even though Biden has made rejoining the Iran nuclear deal one of his priorities. Iran has maintained that international law is the bedrock of negotiations and unlawful sanctions must be removed before any further dialogue. Well, let's talk to political commentator Mohsen Abbas about that story. Good to see you again, Mohsen. So Trump says it's not over yet. World leaders are congratulating Biden. What's the state of play here?
Well, of course, it is a bit premature, although this is the normal customary reaction whenever an election is declared in the way it has been. World leaders usually do congratulate the new president or the incumbent. However, in this instance, of course, there's never been such a kind of heavy, if you like, dose of allegation. And at the moment, that's all they are, because Donald Trump hasn't presented any evidence of a fixing of the elections. But there's certainly a large stir. However, you know, it's really quite premature in the sense that not the official electoral college which is yet to meet and cast their votes, hasn't really declared Biden the president. Many are arguing the Electoral College can't decide anything until lawsuits and court proceedings take place, others are saying. Of course, court proceedings will definitely happen. They're going to happen in Michigan, they're going to happen in Wisconsin, and Georgia, and Pennsylvania. They may happen in Arizona as well, and Nevada. But the Supreme Court is interesting on this because the appointment of Amy Coney Barrett, who was actually appointed by Trump, is obviously something which Trump can look to, and the Supreme Court is looking at Pennsylvania already. All of this, of course, augurs badly for American democracy, and the possibility of conflict, continued conflict, is definitely there.
All right, we'll have to wait and see. But the reason world leaders have rushed to congratulate Biden, do you think it's because there is a sense that the majority of nations wanted for Biden to win, to sort of restore a sense of normality? And do you think a change of administration would mean a change of policy in any meaningful way?
Well, absolutely, they wanted, I think, Biden to win. Certainly his allies across NATO and various others would probably prefer him to win, although the Saudi Arabians haven't declared their acknowledgement of the new presidency. Other than that, his usual allies have. And that is because, you know, he tore up the Paris Agreement, as you mentioned. He tore up the Trans-Pacific treaties. He was destabilizing on so many levels international agreements that, mm-hmm. of course, they want him to rejoin the pack. Of course, JCPOA was the biggest problem of all, which brings in...
Let me put this final question to you before we run out of time. Biden has said he'd re-sign the U.S. into international institutions and agreements, and I want to talk about specifically the Iran nuclear deal. Is Iran to take Biden for his words, briefly?
Iran certainly won't. I don't think their policy is going to change unless, of course, we get a situation where the Americans drop economic sanctions, accept JCPOA as was agreed, arguably, but even that is in question. I think the Iranians are right not to trust Biden, because Biden is a nasty imperialist aggressor himself. You know, he's a Zionist, he's a declared Zionist, so is Kamala Harris. You can't expect any change in their support for Israel and their injustice across West mm-hmm. Asia. So why should Iran trust Biden any more than Trump?
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Mohsen Abbas, political commentator. Thank you, as always. We're going to stick with the U.S. elections as concerns over a transition process linger. The U.S. Vice President, or President-elect, has already gotten down to work. Joining me now, Richard Sedan, to tell us what Joe Biden has been up to. Richard, good to see you.
So, of course, Saeed, the world is continuing to react to the news that Joe Biden is now the president-elect and he'll be the next president of the United States. And, of course, Joe Biden has delivered a speech which everyone is talking about over the last couple of days. The speech was very interesting. Of course, it was full of the kind of usual platitudes you might expect, especially in the wake of a divided country. And there were several nods to Obama within the speech from Joe Biden and also Kamala Harris. But I thought what was interesting in the speech is that Joe Biden said Black America had his back and he is going to have theirs. Now, this is extremely significant. Now, of course, it sounds good on the face of it, but a lot of critics have basically said, look, Joe Biden has not got a good track record regarding Black America. Of course, he was one of the architects of the 94 crime bill, which saw thousands of Black people incarcerated. And of course, you know, the fact is Kamala Harris has been on record actually saying that she's not going to do anything specific for Black Americans. And I think the reality is that Black Americans are dealing with grave injustices in the U.S. They have been for many, many years, and that continues. So I think there's
Now that they've got the vote and they've won the presidency, they're going to go on and forget all about Black Americans.
Well, I think this is the kind of cynical take that a lot of people, frankly, are having. And I think now the task really for many people is that they're going to have to hold Joe Biden's political feet to the fire, so to speak, to make sure he makes good on his promises to Black America. Of course, over the summer, we've seen massive Black Lives Matter protests throughout the country in the wake of the George Floyd killing. But of course, Black injustice, killings at the hands of the state, and also militia groups, some would say often working with the state, have been carrying on for many, many decades. And it seems a stretch to imagine that's going to change anytime soon.
We'll talk about the militia group soon. Bring us the online reaction to this story.
So let's go first to a tweet from filmmaker and activist Tariq Nasheed, who says, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were saved by the black vote. They and the Democrats need to be reminded of this every day as they try to use benign neglect tactics against the very black voters who saved them while they prioritize other groups. A very strong reaction there. And we have a tweet here from journalist Abby Martin, who says, great that Trump is out, but 7 million more people voted for him than in 2016, and COVID is the only reason he barely lost. Biden and surrogates now calling for unity and bipartisanship is a clear signal he'll govern for the GOP centrists and not progressives. Let's get back to fighting the system that bred Trump. Of course, nationalism has been and is on the rise in the United States, and so too is Trumpism, and that's not going to dissipate anytime soon.
Nationalism and Trumpism. Let's move on to your second story. We're going to stay in the United States and threats of violence by some of Donald Trump's far-right militant supporters.
Again, it has been and remains extremely dangerous in the U.S. if you're a black American. And now we see that the alleged Proud Boys leader has declared the standby order has been rescinded, of course, in the wake of the Trump loss. Of course, Trump infamously said, stand by, stand down. And now those very groups that took that as a signal are now saying in the wake of Trump's loss, the time to arguably do what they do is now, and this is extremely worrying. These groups are terrorist groups, people characterize them as that, and they are intent on malicious violence and attacking black people, etc. So everyone's discussing this right now. I want to bring up first, if I can, a reaction on this very point. Let's go to a tweet from an online activist known as Great Black Shark, who says, B1 fam, listen up. Parler is a right-wing white supremacist site where extremists congregate. I monitor them constantly. This is a message between the chairman of the Proud Boys and other members. Stay ready to neutralize any threat. They will be looking for soft targets. And I think we can see an image of the internal conversation on Parler between these Proud Boy individuals who are basically saying, now is the time, stand by no more and roll out. This is extremely dangerous, and people think this should be viewed as a very serious terrorist threat, specifically targeting black Americans. We have another reaction here from What's the Video, who says, my friend in Washington State said the Proud Boys are posting stand by no more roll out. This is crazy. A reminder that this is a nationwide phenomenon, a nationwide problem. And I think if the new president-elect wants to be taken seriously, he needs to take some serious measures to bring about a system of justice for black Americans, where there's been an ongoing system of injustice for many, many years.
All right, Richard Sudan. Richard, thank you as always. All right, time now to look at some other stories this hour. Celebrations in Azerbaijan's capital, Baku, after the country's president, Ilham Aliyev, announced that his country's forces had taken Shusha, the second largest city in the Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. Armenia, however, has denied the town's loss and says fighting is ongoing. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has congratulated the Azeris, saying he believes the remaining lands will be captured too. More than 1,000 people have died in nearly 6 weeks of fighting in and around Nagorno-Karabakh, a mountainous enclave internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but populated and controlled by ethnic Armenians. Thousands have rallied in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, to protest against the results of last week's parliamentary election, accusing the governing body of rigging the polls. The country's Central Election Commission said the ruling Georgian Dream Party won more than 48% of the ballots, with the largest opposition party, United National Movement, UNM, 27%. Eight opposition parties, including UNM, have said they'd boycott the parliament. Protesters rallying outside the Central Election Commission demand that the government hold another vote. So far, the ruling Georgian Dream Party has denied all accusations of fraud. Fears have been raised of the global economic crisis caused by the coronavirus pandemic, triggering new security threats, potentially leading to World War III. Perhaps in preparation for such a scenario, Britain's military is asking for the Treasury to enable long-term investments needed to modernize. Meanwhile, the UK is selling billions of pounds worth of arms, regardless of the human rights records of some of its customers, as Bianca Rahimi reports.
The head of the UK Armed Forces has warned if current, smaller conflicts escalate out of control, drawing in more countries and weapons, World War III might break out. In a Remembrance Day interview with Sky News, General Sir Nick Carter said the world is currently, quote, a very uncertain and anxious place.
We have to remember history might not repeat itself, but it has a rhythm. And if you look back at the last century, before both world wars, I think it was unarguable that there was escalation that led to the miscalculation, which ultimately led to war at a scale we would hopefully never see again.
General Carter says that the British Army will comprise 90,000 human soldiers and 30,000 robots by the 2030s. And aside from modernizing and amplifying its own military, the UK is still the world's second largest arms exporter. Military arms deals worth an estimated £39 billion were approved between 2008 and 2017, a third of which went to countries with abysmal human rights records.
But we have not seen any evidence of that. If we stop selling them the bombs, if we stop selling them the planes, that will have an impact on Saudi and on what Saudi can do in Yemen, because we are one of the main exporters of arms to Saudi Arabia, and frankly, we can't make bombs fast enough for them.
The UK currently has £11 billion worth of orders. So how does stockpiling and exporting arms factor into the UK's World War III game plan?
The UK government has spent hundreds of billions of pounds, large amounts of which have yet to be properly even accounted for, in response to the coronavirus crisis. And General Carter knows full well, I suspect, as do many others in government, that at some point a reckoning for this is going to come, and this money is going to have to be found somewhere, either through tax rises or more likely through departmental budget cuts. And so I think possibly what's the motive here, perhaps more likely than the real worry about regional conflicts becoming a world war, is that actually it's a timely opportunity for General Carter, as head of the UK Armed Forces, to remind yet again for the message that is constantly being put out by the think tanks and the media that support strong armed forces, that is, that the world is a dangerous place.
The world is still reeling from the results of the presidential elections in the US, undisputedly the world's military heavyweight. And although Donald Trump's four-year term was the first without a new war since Eisenhower, his administration has allowed military voices to shout down those of experienced civil servants in the development of foreign policy. Funding cuts to non-defense federal agencies and many career civil servants resigning means policy planning is being entrusted invariably to those in uniform. Bianca Rahimi, London.
A coronavirus vaccine developed by Pfizer and Germany's BioNTech has been found to be more than 90% effective in immunizing people against the virus. Tested on 43,500 people across six countries, the vaccine has posed zero safety concerns so far. The companies say enough safety data will be required by the third week of November to then take the vaccine to regulators. There are currently dozens of COVID-19 vaccines, all of them in stage three trials, but this joint American-German venture is the first to show such hopeful results. Another U-turn by the British government, this time yielding to a campaign led by Manchester United and England striker Marcus Rashford to extend school meals to disadvantaged kids during the Christmas holiday period. Prime Minister Boris Johnson initially ruled out the support for the most needy, but gave in after cafes and restaurants pledged to do the government's job for it. Over the weekend, Johnson called the young footballer to explain his about-face.
It's obviously most important for the families, and you know, on the phone he kept thanking me, but then in the back of my mind I'm like, it's the families that that deserve the U-turn, and I actually thanked him on behalf of the families, because I know 100% they would have wanted to say thank you to him if they had the chance.
Despite being the world's sixth largest economy, the UK is home to millions living in poverty. Austerity measures have cut support over the past 10 years, leaving services at breaking point. And the pandemic has made a difficult situation worse, fueling anger at the government's initial stance. November 11, 2 days from now, Remembrance Day here in the UK. Millions wear a poppy to mark the occasion. Others don't and have disagreements over its use. More now with Robert Carter, a Brit himself. What's the problem with the poppy, Robert?
Well, there's a massive debate that surrounds this logo. Critics of the poppy say that it has become a pro-war establishment symbol used as British propaganda to basically whitewash the UK's crimes abroad. So you have, for example, the fact that the poppy originally came from the end of World War One, but since then, every single war that Britain's been involved in, since then until now, is used and is commemorated and honoured on the same day. So many of those wars Britain was actually the aggressor in, such as the war and invasion and occupation of Iraq and also Afghanistan, just to name a few, but also right-wing racist individuals and politicians in the UK also adopt the poppy as a kind of symbol of British patriotism against the other, against the foreigner, against Islam, all that type of stuff. You also have war criminals or people accused of being war criminals like Tony Blair choosing to wear the red poppy on a year-on-year basis, and he's responsible for massive deaths of both British servicemen and also native innocent Iraqis and Arabs, just to name a few examples. So a very controversial image it has become, and obviously that's expressed online. I can actually play you an example of this debate raging on British TV recently. It's between a white journalist who was criticizing a black anti-racism activist for just tweeting, questioning the poppy and its legacy. Let's play that out now.
Something you, thanks to them, will never ever have to do. It's entirely different. You're now politicising the poppy, which is entirely the wrong thing to do. People wear them out of respect and out of honour to people. And for you to criticise that, to apply terms like wearing a poppy is immoral, absolutely. No, it isn't. No one in this country is forced to wear a poppy. They wear it if they want to, and they wear it for a very specific reason.
Go on, Femi.
You're misusing the term moral. I mean, I said moral absolute as in something we are morally supposed to be doing.
Well, we're not morally supposed to wear a poppy, but people choose to wear them.
And Robert, some would say the ultimate goal of this poppy patriotism or nationalism is to shut down debate around the UK's foreign policy. What have people been saying online about this?
Well, that's a very fair point you make, and obviously there is a degree of fanaticism surrounding the poppy, particularly by right-wing leaning individuals, as you saw in the interview. Any criticism of the poppy gets hounded and shouted down. Let's go to Twitter. There's been a mixed reaction to this. The first tweet I have, let's bring that on screen now, it's criticism of the poppy, which has been expressed across Twitter. So Dumas says, I used to wear a poppy to honour the men who died in World War One and World War Two, but stopped wearing it in 2003 when Tony Blair invaded Iraq illegally and the UK soldiers occupying Afghanistan and Iraq were rebranded as heroes, quote unquote. Let's go to the next tweet again, some criticism of the poppy and what it stands for. Let's bring that up now. It's from Leslie, who says, the poppy is often misused by some as a badge of British patriotism. Of course, it is politicized. Many old soldiers refused to wear them as they felt it glorified war. We are a nation obsessed by war. And third tweet is actually on the other side of the debate. It's defending the poppy here. Mike says, I agree with Carol, the journalist in the earlier interview. Our military are not ideologically driven. They do as they're told to do and risk their lives for the government, whether they agree with it or not. Recognizing their sacrifice has nothing to do with support campaigns they were in.
Let's talk about a man who also was criticized in 2015 for wearing a poppy that wasn't big enough. Jeremy Corbyn, and tell us what's been happening with him.
So obviously the civil war, which is raging in the Labour Party, is continuing. And the latest that we have is obviously former leader Corbyn has continued to be, he may face a possible expulsion from the party, and he remains suspended for the time being. But senior members within the party apparatus have warned fellow MPs who are not allowed to speak out about this dispute publicly going forward. So essentially this has been taken by the left within the party to be a censorship of the dispute, and it hasn't been well received online. The hashtag reinstate Jeremy Corbyn was trending over the weekend, and I can bring you some reaction from that hashtag now. Let's bring up that first tweet and see what it said. It's from a supporter of Jeremy Corbyn, who has been speaking out. It's Ken Loach, who says, "With the government in crisis, this is no time for the Labour Party to turn on itself. We call for the party to reinstate Jeremy Corbyn now." The next tweet, interestingly enough, is from Jeremy Corbyn's son, Tommy Corbyn, who has spoken out. He says that Labour, undoubtedly with the backing of Sir Keir Starmer, is attempting to silence any criticism of this completely outrageous suspension for comments that were completely true. Don't let them. This is insane. So obviously strong words from Corbyn's son there. Corbyn as well has been holding back, hasn't spoken about it so much on Twitter, but he has voiced deep concern about how the Labour Party has been acting.
All right, Robert Carter with those stories. Robert, thank you very much. And that brings us to the end of this broadcast, everyone. We appreciate you spending time with us. I will see you again soon.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In fact, the normalization of hate speech against Muslims not only legitimizes the institutionalized discrimination to which French Muslims are subjected, but also incites violence against them inside and outside France, says Joseph Massed, writer, in an article published under the heading "France's Crisis with Islam: A Legacy of 200 Years of Colonial Brutality." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. France is in crisis. French secularism legitimizing itself under the umbrella of what the French ostentatiously call laïcité continues to increase its attacks on French and non-French Muslims. The Collectif contre Islamophobie en France, CCIF, listed 1,043 Islamophobic incidents that occurred in 2019, a 77% increase since 2017. 68 physical attacks, about 6.5%, 618 incidents of discrimination, about 59.3%, 210 incidents of hate speech and incitement of racial hatred, about 20.1%, 93 incidents of defamation, about 8.9%, 22 incidents of vandalism of Muslim sacred places, about 2.1%, and 32 incidents of discrimination linked to the so-called fight against terrorism, that is about 3.1%. French secular hatred of Muslims is part of everyday speech by the French government, the pundits, and the media. In fact, the normalization of hate speech against Muslims not only legitimizes the institutionalized discrimination to which French Muslims are subjected, but also incites violence against them inside and outside France, including the shootings at Mosque of Brest and the targeting of its popular Imam Rashid al-Jai in June 2019 and the attack on the Mosque of Bayonet in October 2019 that wounded four. Outside France, the terrorists who committed the 2019 massacre at the Christchurch mosques in New Zealand, killing 51 Muslim worshippers and wounding 49, cited the murderous theories of Islamophobic French thinker Renaud Camus as influencing his actions. In October 2019, French President Emmanuel Macron connected terrorism in France to any signs of French Muslims' faith and culture, including having a beard, praying five times a day, eating halal food, etc. This is an old French secular tradition. When Napoleon Bonaparte invaded Egypt and Palestine in 1798, his clever plan was to lie to the Egyptians by announcing that he and his army were faithful Muslims and that they came to liberate Muslims and Islam from the tyranny of the Mamluks. His deception did not work, and the Egyptians rose against him, as did the Palestinians. He returned in defeat to France after his army committed untold atrocities in Egypt and Palestine. Napoleon and France's crisis with Islam 2 centuries ago was that they were defeated in the Palestinian city of Acre. 3 decades later, when France invaded Algeria, the French no longer needed to lie to Muslims to conquer them, rob them, and destroy their places of worship. In 1871, Algerian Muslims revolted again against French rule, with 150,000 people joining the forces of a local cabal leader, Al-Mukrani. The French genocidal machine responded by killing hundreds of thousands, which combined with the French caused famine deaths in late 1860s, resulted in the death of 1 million Algerians, about a third of the population. The French razed dozens of towns and villages to the ground while eliminating the entire elite of Algerian society. But even that did not resolve France's crisis with Islam. In 1901, the French concern about their crisis with Islam increased. This was especially so as France, which is and will become increasingly and without a doubt a great Muslim power, given its acquisition of new colonies with large Muslim populations, needed to know what Islam would be like in 20th century. This became such a grave concern that a colonial quest for knowledge was issued. The editor of the important French colonial journal Questions Diplomatiques, a chronicle, Edmond Fayzi, set out to investigate the question of the future of Islam by the year 2000. The The ongoing institutionalized discrimination by the French state against its Muslim citizens shows no signs of abatement under Macron. France continues to be submerged in a dominant discourse of chauvinism and hate today that is not dissimilar to the one that always dominated French culture even before the French Revolution. It is true that the widespread white supremacist and fascist culture of hate across Europe and the United States today, reminiscent of the European culture of hate in 1930s, is not exclusive to France, but the French excel at expressing it with minimal euphemisms. The crisis that France continues to face with Muslims is the crisis of French chauvinism, and the refusal of the white supremacists and like French to recognize that their country is a third-rate neo-colonial power with a dominant retrograde culture that insists on holding on to underserved past glories when they need to repent their genocidal sins that extend from the Caribbean to Southeast Asia to Africa and that killed millions of people since late 18th century. What the French need to do is to pay back the debts they owe to all people whom they robbed and killed around the world since then. Only that will end France's crisis with Islam and with itself.
Around the world with reporters.
The head of the UK Armed Forces has warned if current smaller conflicts escalate out of control, drawing in more countries and weapons, World War III might break out. In a Remembrance Day interview with Sky News, General Sir Nick Carter said the world is currently, quote, a very uncertain and anxious place.
We have to remember history might not repeat itself, but it has a rhythm. And if you look back at the last century, before both world wars, I think it was unarguable that there was escalation that led to the miscalculation, which ultimately led to war at a scale we would hopefully never see again.
General Carter says that the British Army will comprise 90,000 human soldiers and 30,000 robots by the 2030s. And aside from modernizing and amplifying its own military, the UK is still the world's second largest arms exporter. Military arms deals worth an estimated £39 billion were approved between 2008 and 2017, a third of which went to countries with abysmal human rights records.
But we have not seen any evidence of that. If we stop selling them the bombs, if we stop selling them the planes, that will have an impact on Saudi and on what Saudi can do in Yemen, because we are one of the main exporters of arms to Saudi Arabia, and frankly, we can't make bombs fast enough for them.
The UK currently has £11 billion worth of orders. So how does stockpiling and exporting arms factor into the UK's World War III game plan?
The UK government has spent hundreds of billions of pounds, large amounts of which have yet to be properly even accounted for, in response to the coronavirus crisis. And General Carter knows full well, I suspect, as do many others in government, that at some point a reckoning for this is going to come. And this money is going to have to be found somewhere, either through tax rises or more likely through departmental budget cuts. And that time is fast approaching when indeed the British government, as indeed other governments, are going to have to start doing the mathematical reckoning for their spending. And so I think possibly what's the motive here for General Carter as head of the UK Armed Forces to remind yet again for the message that is constantly being put out by the think tanks and the media that support strong armed forces, that is that the world is a dangerous place.
The world is still reeling from the results of the presidential elections in the US, undisputedly the world's military heavyweight. And although Donald Trump's four-year term was the first without a new war since Eisenhower, his administration has allowed military voices to shout down those of experienced civil servants in the development of foreign policy. Funding cuts to non-defense federal agencies and many career civil servants resigning means policy planning is being entrusted invariably to those in uniform. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The United States has not been so divided in recent memory as there are two people claiming to be president. The mainstream media rushed to accept Joe Biden's declaration of victory, even though he has an average lead of only 32,000 votes in three states in a vote which is not even finished counting yet. Donald Trump has also claimed victory prematurely. It appears half the country believes Biden is the president-elect, while the other half believes Trump is the president-elect. No one knows what will happen next, and many fear tensions could elevate into violence.
Joe Biden has won. Trump may contest it, but the evidence is there. There is no illegal things regarding vote. The system has worked, and it will continue. One man will not ruin this system for us. Joe Biden is now our president.
And one thing I want to add, it's not Republican versus Democrat. We are Americans.
Special about our country.
Period.
But mail-in ballots were used in unprecedentedly massive numbers, and the vote's legality has been openly disputed for many months. It seems certain the courts will ultimately decide the legality of the vote, and maybe even who won, as in the year 2000, which caused massive political alienation, cultural division, and mistrust. The lack of trust is also because the U.S. election process is considered the worst of any of the core Western democracies. That's according to the Harvard-based Electoral Integrity Project, whose 2019 index ranked U.S. elections just 57th in the world. Pro-Biden corporate media is seemingly acting as if there is no dispute at all, while skeptical pro-Trump outlets insist this unique election must be vetted by the courts, and that Trump must not concede before that process is finished.
I think he'll just give it up eventually. People will stop giving him airtime, stop giving him attention, and he'll just give up. He'll figure out another way to be in the news and all over the place.
Both sides appear to be bewildered by the stance of the other side, and both sides are certain of their own righteousness. With two presidents, many say the U.S. election could not have turned out worse, and the worst seems yet to come. Rami Mazahiri, Chicago.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has congratulated U.S. President-elect Joe Biden. In a statement, Abbas said he looks forward to working with the president-elect and his administration. Palestinian officials have expressed their satisfaction with the departure of outgoing President Donald Trump and said for them nothing was worse than Trump's era.
We welcome the results of the American elections. Like many world states, we agree that Trump's era was a nightmare. As President Abbas said, we are looking forward to achieve freedom, independence, justice, and dignity for our people. All previous U.S. administrations had specific commitments towards Israel, but this time we hope we can cooperate with the new administration.
Several Palestinian political groups have also expressed their satisfaction with, in the first place, the departure of President Donald Trump, the man who took several anti-Palestinian measures, including recognition of Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital in late 2017, moving the U.S. embassy there, and declaring the so-called deal of the century. This had led the Palestinian Authority to halt its political dealings with Trump's administration.
We don't expect to witness a great difference between U.S. administrations and the Israeli regime. But Trump tarnished U.S. image and harmed its interests in the region. I hope Biden can make the U.S. committed to international law. Biden and Trump differ in everything, in performance and reasoning.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who was among Trump's close allies around the world, waited 12 hours to congratulate Biden.
but at the same time, he thanked Trump for taking U.S.-Israel ties to an unprecedented level.
For Palestinians, a change of administration in the U.S. is not a promise of change in Washington's policy toward them. However, Palestinians do hope for a gain in Donald Trump's departure, as his term in office is considered the worst even among most hostile U.S. presidents. Muraqandil, Occupy Ramallah.